Good. All right, so various announcements I wanted to talk about. First, so we don't have anybody on the phone. There's a chance Paul Butler was going to call in, a bit unclear, but rather than listen to music, waiting for that. So not even. So Bryson will monitor that, and if I get a call or an email, I'll try to monitor that too. I know Chanel had emailed to say she had a conflict, and hadn't heard from Helder, so but I'm assuming he's good with where he is. All right. So, Helder Gill, who's our representative from the deputy mayor's office. Helder's—he's listening. We've got him on the phone a few times before, but
he used to be at MPD.
Yeah, I know him.
Yeah.
You know him well. He's at all my meetings. I just didn't know he ever attended this one.
He is, yes.
By phone.
Yes, he's been on, yes.
Sometimes.
I didn't realize how much more fun it is in person.
That's right, as I'm sure many, many people wish they were here.
He's in person. And that's why he does this one by phone.
All right, so a few things, some happy announcements first. Janu is not here because Janu is on paternity leave.
That's happy.
He had a daughter, Evelyn, was born August 14th, and so he's on leave, and not totally sure when he'll be back, but perhaps here towards the end of September. Anyway, I wanted to wish him the best. And then I wanted to recognize Chris down here at the end, Chris Westfall. He's a Georgetown Law student, second 2L now, and is going to be doing a fall externship. To us, it's kind of an internship, but to him, it's an externship. Doing some work while, having a regular full class load. So we appreciate it.
Georgetown.
What else to say? Couple other things. Just want to, always try to slip this in there, let you know a little bit, on our ongoing efforts to get hold of statistics. Again, we had a lot of good forward movement. The Superior Court, particularly thanks to Chief Judge's help, we were able to get quite a few of the data fields that we were hoping for. And we're not yet analyzing them. Again, we're having assistance from the lab and the Office of the City Administrator. We're going back a bit now to Superior Court to kind of tweak one of the variables that we were looking at and see if we can get do a slightly different search. So it'll still be a bit until we have some preliminary data, but it is happening, and that's exciting. So we'll keep you posted on that, and when it becomes available, at least some basic frequency data, what's being charged and convicted, we'll get that out as soon as we can. But it may be a while. Sure.
We never considered the impact on the juvenile justice system, right? On data, and I'm just wondering if anybody's ever looked.
Sure.
What the frequencies are in one system versus the other.
You bet. So, great question. And I think Don's probably better suited to answer that because I think he's tackled that from other angles through working with the lab. But I would say for our part, the difficulties in getting data are increased exponentially when the various confidentiality and record sealing issues all come forward. So what we're getting is adult data. It includes YRA sentences.
Confidentiality shouldn't be an issue when we're talking about gross numbers. Inconvenience of the court and things like that might be an issue, but confidentiality should be an issue. They report to Congress a lot of those numbers in their annual reports.
Right. I hear you.
I'll drop it.
Yeah, no.
To me, it seems like it at least is a question of inquiry, especially maybe not proportionality because of the sentencing structure,
sure,
but about how offenses are charged, or maybe the difference between the types of crimes juveniles commit versus adults, if any.
You bet.
I don't know the answer to that.
These are, I mean, absolutely important questions, and again, I'd let Don speak in a second, but one thing I'd say is, you know, again, the court has been, you know, careful and sensitive about the data it's distributing and how it's distributed. Even the basic adult frequency numbers that we're getting, for instance, are subject to a data use agreement, which restricts our ability to circulate some of that information. So all of which is to say, I think they have a range of concerns, and we've had to kind of like engage with that and try to meet them. And I think confidentiality, right, even for matters of public record or from the aggregate, it may be that we could find a way to do this, but I would just say I think it would be much more difficult. So this is where we are now.
Okay.
Would love to come back to that. And Don, I don't know if there's anything else you want to add about like ability to access juvenile data.
Not
that
juvenile
you
data, but that seems like a reasonable request to make to the court to ask for aggregate. Like once you have a sense of how to frame the question for adults, we just have to frame the same question in aggregate for the juveniles. We'll probably have some MPE data for you soon.
The even for the adult data, they have a general policy about kind of any numbers. I think it's below 20 is their magic number or something. So like they require both aggregate and then a kind of a certain level. So they're requiring that even for adults. So maybe we could figure something
Rich,
out.
Don't,
yeah. What's your
you don't
record?
Need to spend a lot of time. I'm
yeah, yeah.
a point person on
yeah.
having a child. I
yeah,
understand
yeah.
the
yeah, yeah,
law
yeah.
of small
yeah.
numbers and I don't,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
So
good.
We can talk about it offline
good.
If you want or not. I mean,
good.
Whatever.
Appreciate that. Yes. Scheduling issues. So we have another meeting. This is kind of a makeup meeting scheduled for September 19th, 2 o'clock. Send out the agenda. It'll go up online here shortly. It's on our website shortly. It's already up on the kind of other public place we have to post things. And I would suggest, again, so we've got this whole cluster of property offenses. I would suggest for that meeting, for that next one, if people want to focus on reviewing report number 9, which is theft and damage to property offenses, that might be, you know, whatever we can discuss today on the definitions and whatnot, and then we'll carry that over and maybe add into the mix theft and damage to property offenses. That would be my suggestion. For the rest, it's in around about scheduling for October, November, and December of this year. The issue was, one of our members had a change in scheduling and trying to accommodate that, so I was trying to see if we could switch back. It sounds like switching back somewhat might work, but because it was a different permutation than I emailed about, I wanted to check with everybody here if like 3 to 5 p.m., so not going all the way to 3:15, but just like 3 to 5 p.m. for the times for the dates we already have on October 4th, November 1st, and December 6th would still work. Again, I think that might, if it doesn't cause problems for you all here at the table, it would help Paul, who has a new teaching schedule.
And that's different from your last year.
Yeah, well, so this is about these three remaining this year, and then for next year we scheduled for 2018. That we set. And yeah, it sounded like those dates for 2018 work for everybody, but the question is even for this, you know, he's got a fall teaching schedule, and I think, again, we'd set this, if it's no difficulty for others, then I think it'd be great to move it to 3 to 5, but if it does cause difficulty, you know, we'll stick with what we've got, which is the normal 2 to 4. So, and any concerns or objections about that, again, three, it would be from moving from 2 to 4 to 3 to 5, so just starting an hour later, going an hour later on October 4th, November 1st, December 6th. So that's good. Good. All right. Well, if let me know soon if you do have a problem with any of those dates, and I have to check on room availability and see that, but I'll follow up with an email then to confirm. But that would be the change. Let's see. The other thing I wanted to mention, again, I kind of mentioned one of the recent emails, sequencing-wise, in part because, well, a number of things, but I think our plan now is to switch and do drug offenses later and do offenses against persons earlier. So we'll have conspiracy ready for your review here in November. And then after that, expecting to go into offenses against persons. Perhaps not all in one giant grouping. Might break it up into two groupings. So like in December, for instance, might be, you know, several offenses against persons that are kind of coherent. And then another group, you know, later on, maybe in February or something like that.
Can I just ask, yep. You said conspiracy ready for us in November. And just as a guess, not yep. to hold you to it, with a comment due date of January?
I don't know. I think it depends how big and involved it ends up being. You know, we want to respect your time. It's also the overall, you know, amazingly, we have less than 13 more months, right, on our statutory authorization. Unless we are extended and there's a change, 13 months to do a bunch. So I don't know, frankly, on how quickly a conspiracy, the turnaround would be. My guess is, I will say, you know, it's one of these where, as in some of the general provisions, the statutory language, going to be pretty short, right? Like, it's the commentary, going to be pretty long.
So, well, like, attempts yeah. in terms of length and detail.
So, you know, it's a lot of background and a lot of, you know, conceptual lifting for what in the end is actually fairly little statutory language. So, but wanted to let everybody know that. And with that, I guess maybe we'll just go on then into some of the written comments and any, you know, we received. First on the draft of report number 6, which was about penalty enhancements. Received a number of comments. Got them on the screen, but wanted to just talk about a few. I don't know that we need to go through all of them, but we'll certainly open it up in case anybody has additional thoughts or concerns they wanted to raise. So on property enhancements, let me start first with kind of, you know, a few of the OAG comments were focused on 22A805, which I'll pull up, and it was this provision about whether enhancements are applied to offenses with equivalent elements. But let me pull that up on the screen so we can all kind of see that together. Here we go. And the short answer, which I'm hoping takes care of OAG's concerns for everybody, is that I think we can, at this point, eliminate altogether the subsection which was of concern. So he was concerned about, let's see, this 805A, okay? Highlighted up on the screen. I will try to expand it here so it's a little bit bigger, so more easily to read. Okay, so 805A, which said, notwithstanding any other provision of law, an offense is not subject to a penalty enhancement in this chapter when that offense contains an element in one of its gradations which is equivalent to the penalty enhancement. And OAG had a number of kind of just clarification, but, you know, what exactly do you mean by equivalent here? You know, like, how does this work? And on kind of reviewing that, our take was, look, this is tricky to have categorical broad language that's supposed to encompass how this works. So I think what we'd like to do for now is to strike this and say, look, let's keep an eye out for this when this becomes an issue. Because at this point, we only, again, here there are only three of these broad general penalty enhancements, right? Hate crimes, recidivists, and offenses committed during release equivalent. So, you know, that's what we're talking about, right? And frankly, certainly in the existing code, rare that any of those, that we have any offenses that duplicate those elements. There are some. And as we hit them, we will consider whether or not we need to have some special provision that says, hey, for this offense we can't have both. But frankly, it seems like a better solution to just not state this in some general terms, right? And if and when we have a problem, we'll deal with the problem in the individual offense. So that was, I assume that then takes care of
it. No, that takes care of it. Yeah. I personally, I'd rather deal with it in small ones, but yeah. I just have problems with all of that,
sure.
Especially with word like equivalence.
Sure. Absolutely. And then your point was, you know, we've carefully defined it in some other places. So anyway, any thoughts or comments on that? So that's one. Let's see. The next kind of set of comments concern, and of course, then the commentary on this would go too. So the 805A will go in the second draft and the corresponding commentary. On the prior convictions, let me scroll down to this. So let's see, 806F5 is where. There we go. The definition of prior convictions for the recidivist penalty enhancement. The question coming from OIG was what is meant by occasion here? Okay. So what we have right now for purposes of the section, prior convictions means convictions by any court or courts of the District of Columbia, state or federally recognized Indian tribe of the United States and its territories, provided that convictions for two or more offenses committed on the same occasion or during the same course of conduct shall be counted as one conviction. What I would propose, and kind of explain a little bit where we were coming from on that, was trying to look and understand what was going on with the current standard in the voluntary sentencing guidelines, which, you know, to all appearances is widely followed. Like, you know, we don't seem to see any problem with this. In the voluntary sentencing guidelines, there's this notion instead of an event, right? And the voluntary sentencing guidelines defines an event as offenses are part of a single event if they were committed at the same time and place or have the same nucleus of facts. Now, that's a novel thing, right? So, like, what we have in practice right now is, you know, for property offenses, certainly, right? You only get one sentence that they run concurrent if they are based on the same event, a single event, and they are based on the single event if they were committed at the same time and place or had the same nucleus of facts. So what we're trying to do is figure out, okay, to kind of reflect this current practice that we have, what language is comparable? And occasion was a stab at that, but I think on reflection, rather than go down this path that is tricky, right? Like even to exactly follow what the sentencing guidelines have done, you know, the sentencing guidelines definition is open to question two, you know, what do some of these terms mean, is to restrict it to the same act or course of conduct. Two or more offenses committed as part of the same act or course of conduct. Now, you know, that phrasing, act or course of conduct, is the kind of like standard language which is used in double jeopardy, case law in the district and Supreme Court. It's the same language that we have right now in the concurrent consecutive sentencing statute. In the end, there still are important questions. I think OIG had kind of raised some of these more basically, like, all right, well, still, there's this question, what does course of conduct mean, right? And that is a legitimate question. I would say it's one that we can't or cannot and do not want to fully resolve. And it would depend, I think, in part on like what is the unit of prosecution for a particular offense, which, you know, in a few offenses, the Court of Appeals has wrestled with and decided, you know, based on usually reading some tea leaves kind of deep in the legislative history to suss out what is the unit of prosecution. They've done that. We have not been drafting with an eye to specifying for every offense what a relevant unit of prosecution is, right? You know, so for instance, again, you know, there's a theft, you take a handbag, inside the handbag is an article belonging to Dave and another article belonging to Laura. And, you know, so there are multiple parties' property who are taken as part of the same act of taking this handbag. Is that considered, you know, should those then run, what is the unit of prosecution there? Is that one act of theft? Or is that theft from multiple people by that one action? This kind of parsing, it's important, right? And it's relevant, but it's also like at such a level of detail that we're not going there. We haven't been going there, and we would just assume not go there in the statute. So what I think what we'd recommend doing is just, again, going with the same language of same act or course of conduct, which, again, is the same language and the lens through which the DCCA has applied in its double jeopardy jurisprudence in terms of, okay, is where the question is usually, are these multiple punishments for the same act or course of conduct? Is it the same offense that's going on here that we're talking about? So with that, would that change kind
of
address?
I like the act. Yeah. It addresses one issue.
Okay.
The example I gave was of a different nature. Yep. I agree we shouldn't get into if a purse has six people's things in it, how many. Yep. But my example purposely was something that was two different acts, mm-hmm. for which could be argued is a course of conduct.
Yeah.
But I thought the law on that is they would be two different charges, that they would not merge into some similar kind of thing like a purse example.
Right.
That's not what this is about.
But I'm just defining course of conduct. I just want to make sure nobody debates course of conduct. I'm not getting...
I see.
That's all I'm trying to get. And in fact, an example might just take care of it.
Let me pull up...
To say that that's not what it's about.
Let me pull up Dave's example. Got a lot of documents. Too many documents. Over. Let me go back and just pull it off the way. So this is, let's see, two pages.
Splits right there.
Yeah.
Take for example.
Yeah. So Dave said, unfortunately, the addition of the phrase "during the same course of conduct" does not clarify. Take for example the following scenario: an in-home worker who visits an elderly patient once a week is convicted for stealing from the victim. Afterwards, the government learns that the in-home worker actually started working for the patient at an earlier time and also stole from the patient during that previous time period. Would a second conviction of the in-home worker be the subject of an enhancement under this provision, or would it be considered the same course of conduct? Either the proposed code provision or the commentary should address this. You know, again, my take would be most likely... That seems like a good example of separate events, right? You know, but even the test for this, right? You know, whether it's a course of conduct, you know, I don't know, right? Like, you know, we have a whole set of doctrines, right? You know, you have the fork in the road doctrine, right? Which like would suggest that a very minimal amount of time or change is sufficient. To, in the absence of other statutory intent or legislative intent, establish that this was a separate offense that satisfied that. But I don't know.
That doctrine's for a really different purpose.
Absolutely.
I don't know if Dave is saying this, although it seems like if we ever had to go down that road, or at least we want to make sure we're not complicating or bringing together, ending up with a definition of course of conduct in this context that either reflects back to, right, that's like multiplicity, right?
Yes.
I mean,
multiplicity is a fair way to, yes.
It's the act individuation part of multiplicity, so it's like trying to figure out how many rapes are there.
Right.
Yeah.
And that seems to me as a really, it cannot be that the way you end up with that result. There's no point in having this prior conviction restriction if the analysis is exactly the same as the multiplicity one. So we have to make sure that language is really different, right? Or at least it's clear that you intend the concepts to be really different.
I'm not sure that we do.
We certainly do in the sentencing with the guidelines.
Yes. So in what's unclear is where to draw this line, right? Like, so with the sentencing,
there may be some overlap.
Yep.
It's not the same.
This is a fair question, and I think you know having discussion and clarifying this is absolutely right. I think you know, yes, the voluntary sentencing guidelines are getting at something different. What the voluntary sentencing guidelines have is a unique thing that does not appear otherwise in case law anywhere, right? So, drawing a line, trying to figure out where this line is, I don't know how we can do that. The voluntary sentencing guidelines, what they would say is, offenses are part of a single event if they were committed at the same time and place and have the same nucleus of facts. All right? So you've got some notion of time and place being involved. Now, those are, to a degree, also involved in the same kind of multiplicity conception of act or course of conduct, right? You know, when they're assessing whether it was met or not, for instance, there's kind of a grisly sex assault case, which I think that kind of put a fine point on this, which was like, you know, did the act, you know, occur in this one room, or was it in the time and the different location to move into the adjoining room, right? And you know, so time and place, how closely they are related, is definitely part of that. There's no magic line in there, right? Like they, you know, the courts would kind of wrestle at that. But then the nucleus, same nucleus of facts, not clear to me what that means, right? And so, yeah.
Who knows what any of it means, right? And it's the guideline, so it's not like the Court of Appeals has taken it up.
Exactly.
It is, however, not the same, right? I mean, this is clearly a restriction.
Yes.
And
same
if the analysis
of,
was the same,
that's
it wouldn't, there'd be no point in putting this in. So we are at least going to be clear. It cannot be the same analysis. Otherwise, however many convictions you got, it must be okay, unless you should never have had those multiple convictions. Right?
Not necessarily. So again, the whole multiplicity analysis, you know, and some of this looking at, you know, whether acts were part of the same act or course of conduct, is, you know, again, it's ultimately subject trying to read in legislative intent, right? So, for instance, right now, RSP and theft, right? You can have, you know, multiple convictions, right, based on the same act, right, because we have a clear legislative
and
intent.
And when you're talking about an enhancement based on a prior conviction, are you, I just want to understand. It's the position of you all, the committee, however we're calling you, that sometimes there should be an enhancement both on the receiving stolen property and the whatever, shoplifting, the theft. You're saying sometimes that's true? I thought this language meant you get one of those, you don't get both. That sometimes, maybe there is some overlap in analysis
right.
and some complicated thing, but
that's
it
right.
isn't just because you could charge both of those, you get both. Somewhere the analysis departs. For purposes
I guess
of the penalty,
I guess what this does, what this would still do then, by having this precluding convictions arising from the same act or course of conduct, is yes, it would eliminate these kinds of duplicities where are multiple.
Whatever.
Where you're, like, for instance, RSP and theft based on the same act. I say that, and I'm...
There you are again.
I'm moderately comfortable with what I've just said.
So I would just say that there's two different issues. But there's the offense overlap issue, where you can have the same act or course of conduct could satisfy the elements of 7, 9, 10 offenses, right? Like any given carjacking is likely to be carjacking, robbery, theft. I mean, you know, and so, and they, at least under current district law, they don't merge because they're not LIOs of one another. So this surely would say
right,
that.
So carjacking and robbery.
Exactly. This, at minimum, the act or course of conduct would preclude the enhancement from applying there. But that's a separate issue. So that is one place where, without a doubt, it is a much more generous than like an elements test, let's say, in terms of the application of the recidivist enhancement. Now, as to the second point, I think you raised a fair point, which is, and it's a question to be clarified, right? So the current version of the recidivist enhancement just uses on the same occasion, just that language in terms of, and I, you know, I'm not sure what the legislative intent there was. Presumably, it was to expand some way, perhaps above and beyond, perhaps not. Let's say the fresh impulse test as to how many of the same offense was committed in a given period of time.
That was our pitching. The same occasion is our pitching. So Laura, I'm not sure if this addresses your concern. I think going with same act or course of conduct. Kind of in the first point, Michael said, it still does work, right, by having it here as compared to it not existing.
Okay.
I think it doesn't go as far as where the voluntary sentencing guidelines do. They go a step further, and again, with language which is, it's the same nucleus of facts, which really, I kind of scratch my head, right, like the reference to that, because you know, it's squishy, right? Like the same nucleus of fact. You know, all the facts are the same. No, some of them are the same, or many of them are the same. And these are just really conceptually tricky things to draw a line on because, so all of which is to say, what we're trying to find is a clear line. And so that's why I'm suggesting we go instead with act or course of conduct, which at least, now again, is a lesser barrier than the current guidelines have. I definitely agree with that, but I agree. I also think it's more than one would otherwise have if this were not in there, relying only on kind of like merger. And,
well,
that help
I'm going to...
Yep.
I'm only going to stop talking... Because I hijacked Dave's point,
yep.
So I'll wait, but I'm not done.
Good.
No, feel free. Okay. I'm saying is I don't know that satisfies me to what that means in a given situation.
Yep.
And to say courts look at legislative intent,
yep.
I find a little bit problematic because the commentary does not say and we should, the court should continue to look at whatever they would have looked at before this was enacted. Otherwise, this is the legislative history, and that sort of becomes circular on, I don't understand how to argue it at that point, where, where we're not acknowledging the current, whatever it is, exists.
Sure.
Actually, the concepts here are always going to be vague in the borders, whatever you go with. I think there's a question as to whether or not, if you stick with after course of conduct, that is essentially, to go to Laura's point, that is essentially saying, yes, generally speaking, we want whatever the fresh impulse, however the DCCA would approach these sorts of act individuation questions as in terms of charging conviction, that's the same test we want to apply here to the multiple convictions. But to be fair, I mean, after course of conduct, what that means is ambiguous. You could also go with a broader concept, which is also going to be ambiguous. You could call it event, you could call it occasion, and you could specify in legislative intent that it is the legislature's intent for this to be more expansive than the fresh impulse, you know, after course of conduct, without having to provide sort of like the full details of what that concept is going to be, because with all this stuff, it's kind of mushy. But it, you know, you could still pick a broader concept and just say that it was intended that this concept be broader. It's a policy choice.
In a policy choice, which you might have very different intuitions about. I don't mean to.
No, I think I confused myself.
Okay, there we go.
Did everybody else realize that like a long time ago? No.
Okay, here's what I want it. Here's where I want it to come out, right? Yeah. To me, this is a, and maybe this is, it's a, more of these should count as one. You have one. How many in a thing are we counting as, right? I mean, you're getting your enhancement for the prior conviction, right? To me, it should come closer to the guidelines test, right? And the reason why we have that in the guidelines has to do with counting criminal history and moving someone across, which is already a double counting, which presumably will still exist even when this is done, right? So it's one thing to say, you know, my gun conviction from this year and my gun conviction from 5 years ago ought to count as only one to enhance. It's another when the stuff is a lot closer, even if it's not the exact, it's not the carjacking and the robbery, but it is the sex assault in this room and the sex assault in this room and the beating that started out in the hallway. Yeah. I mean, it's an enhancement. Pile it all in, count it as one. You're getting your one.
Well, how many do you get? I mean, like, that's the ultimate question.
You
get
one.
Like, yeah, and I think, well, and this kind of, again, goes to, like, I don't, maybe I'll remember some from, you know, you know, where that language came up in the sentencing guidelines. You know, maybe it was a very pragmatic compromise decision about, like, you know, where we draw a line on. I don't know what the background was on coming up with that, but, like, you know, look, in part this goes to, again, what are these enhancements doing, right? And how much you want to penalize or further penalize somebody for prior acts. And, you know, there is this, at a very macro level, one notion that you know, just as you have in a lot of jurisdictions, you know, similar types of language, right? Like, they're trying to get at the same notion of, like, how do we count the multiple past bad choices, right? And do we count, like, okay, on this one day, right, you did five terrible things, but it's all in that one day, and you got a sentence for all of those on the same one day. Do we count that as, you know, five separate acts, or do we count that as essentially like that was one really bad day? And so, like, they're the fundamental notions about that, I think, which are at play here. But yeah,
is there disagreement about Laura's point? Because if there isn't disagreement among the stakeholders about Laura's point, then that puts a different perspective on it.
From my perspective, given all the options, I'd rather move the way it is.
The way it is, meaning on the board with
the
occasion. Okay.
The way it was proposed.
Okay.
Then to change it to any of the other options that it doesn't want to take.
Okay.
I would just point out, occasion is the language also used.
I mean, I like act. I'm sorry. I apologize.
There we go.
Occasion. I'm sorry, but I did. Good. As opposed to other ways that got kicked around. In
gotcha. So you would prefer changing this to act or course of conduct versus what was in the first draft, occasion or course of conduct. So we do have some difference there.
And
right?
More your point is, right, like, the point is you're getting a ding for a prior.
Right.
And the prior should be a prior.
A prior.
Right.
And if you've got another A prior from a really different time, well, then I guess you get a ding twice.
Right. And the question is just how much is the really different time? Like, was it different day?
It was like a different decade.
Yeah, was it a different day? And
is this person coming back again after getting the first ding and doing something else? Or they,
right.
That's your
perspective. So I think, again, like, I would say this. Like, the two difficulties I see kind of just for the whole group here is, one, in practice, we have the guidelines, right? This is used, right? This has been used for a long time. I don't know if it's been difficult or not. Again, like, it's nothing that we would get a pellet, you know, there's no body of anything interpreting that language, but it is heavily used, and it's been used for years in the guidelines. So I think that is a go-to place where it's very reasonable to put in here as well. I think the other reasonable place is act or course of conduct, which has been, you know, apart from this, the way the court has tried to, like, figure this stuff out, where we draw the lines between act individuation, between multiple instances of an offense, or, you know, how what happens in practice is parsed for legal liability. Those are, I think, kind of the two options. And so if we could get it even down to those two, I feel like that would be progress, right? Act or course of conduct, or something which is essentially kind of, but perhaps with somewhat greater clarity, I don't know, what we have right now in the voluntary sentencing guidelines. Would everybody agree on that? Those are kind of the two choices that there's a basis for out there. Does that make sense? That, Dave, does that kind of, those are the options kind of, and then just different kind of ways of weighing, which is, you know, as a policy choice, which is better. It sounds like that we have some difference of opinion.
I just say on page 9, I think this is just an English thing.
Sure, is this in the commentary or?
Yes.
Explaining
this. I think you've got an or and you mean to have an and.
Could well be.
Because then you say what a prior conviction must be, which is...
I'm sorry, so on page 9, does this look like what I've got on the screen here?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Right, subsection F also provides a definition of prior convictions. Can you make that bigger?
This?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just, you know, the whole screen. Right. So see how convictions rely upon blah, 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 must have been committed on, and you have or, but isn't it and? Because now you're saying what does count, not what doesn't. The definitions, this explanation is the reverse of the definition, right? And the definition is or, so this is and.
Subsection
right?
F also.
I'm not good at English. This is really a question for Renata.
Occasions.
But I've turned myself in knots on this, so I might be wrong. But.
Different occasions or.
Yeah, it should be and.
Different courses of conduct.
Yeah. Because either a single occasion or a single course of conduct would satisfy it.
But it shouldn't. You have to done, it has to be both.
Yeah, it has to be both here.
So it has to be.
Yeah.
Well, Bryson's our Renata on these things, on these matters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all. I don't.
It's a compliment. It's a compliment. Okay. So good. Well, I'm not sure what else to say. To the extent that, like, I feel like either of these are potentially clear, and there's some base, you know, basis for drawing the lines either at act or course of conduct or the guidelines type definition. And we may just have a difference on kind of policy options here. We can go back and take a look at this, given those two options, and again, kind of, you know, evaluate again, kind of where other jurisdictions are on this, right? This is a problem, right?
Like, maybe less what the word is,
yeah,
than that one sentence doesn't okay. do enough to explain. I know where I want the world to turn out. I don't know how to write it.
Okay.
I think what Dave is saying is he wants the world to be a little different. Yeah. I can't tell from your commentary which world you're living in.
Okay, I actually am not sure how different I want it. I just wanted to, I'm not just sure what it means.
Right.
In other words, how it can be argued
right.
or interpreted differently. I just think it's taking right. me time. Where it's going is a different issue.
Right. I would say this. Like, so again, we've got same time and place or same nucleus of facts in the guidelines. So time and place coincident, which is a lot like same act, right? Like it's a very moment. It's same time and place. The alternative again under the guidelines is nucleus of facts. Now that arguably is kind of like a course of conduct, which is to say, like a course of conduct can happen over time in different places. But, for instance, it's like a fraudulent scheme or something of this sort, which had multiple components that was part of one crime of defrauding a person, right? So I think that's where course of conduct is similar to where the guidelines went with same nucleus of facts. So I'm not sure, you know, I don't know to what extent these are the same or different, right? In part, it goes to how, in practice, the voluntary sentencing guideline language is being played out. And I just, you know, there's no appellate opinions on this, right? You know, there's just no way to know. This is up to many, many judges and many, many practitioners making many, many arguments and decisions.
Different subject.
Sure.
So, totally out of order, out of turn, not following the rules. But I have a note here that didn't make it into our comments. But if it's non-controversial, if it is, then maybe it's something you would consider. And that is a 5. So this is prior convictions, right? Blah, blah, blah. Number 4 being a conviction for which a person has been pardoned should not be counted as a conviction. Although I liked OAG's suggestion about sealed. On grounds of innocence. I had forgotten to write number 5. How about a conviction for an offense that subsequently was decriminalized or legalized?
That would be an addition? Gotcha.
If that's not right. controversial. Not that it's not uncomplicated, because we know, in fact, that it can be.
Right.
Just
well, sidebar here. Right, so I think, yeah, it's related to this statute, so we'll...
Just so my position is clear, I don't have a problem with subsequently legalized. I think that's the way the we've been doing it.
Decriminalized.
So either decriminalized and what we said about actual innocence.
Okay.
I think should be tweaked as well.
Okay.
There are things I don't think you should be thinking for.
Okay. Great. That sounds like a friendly amendment that was accepted.
And I guess, you know, in the context of sentencing, we've been very careful about that because some things are not completely decriminalized. Mm-hmm. They're decriminalized to some extent. So.
So it's like a conviction for conduct that has subsequently been decriminalized or legalized shall not be counted as a conviction is probably the language that comes closer to what we've been struggling with, but at least is the truth.
1 ounce of marijuana possession doesn't count. 3 ounces of marijuana possession counts.
Okay.
that makes sense.
So just make sure we get language that's precise enough to deal with.
Yeah,
it.
Right. It's probably right as opposed to the offense was decriminalized, the conduct was. Right. Yeah.
Okay. That's helpful. Let me also, sorry, pull up. I would have it here. The current prior convictions language is going to be in that. Okay. So Michael's pointing out. Yeah, let me see if I can find it for it. So. Yeah, it's just never been litigated. So. Right. So let's see, it's right, teaching him 4A. So I'm gonna hopefully have it here. That's right. So Michael's pointing out that, again, occasion is the language in the current 1804 22-1804A recidivist language. The current recidivist penalty uses this same occasion type language. Again, it's nothing that's ever been litigated. There's no.
We did something really recent.
I'll pull it up here in just a second.
Like prostitution? Sorry. What was it? There's another one. This is going to sound terrible on the record. I'm associating it with Mendelssohn. The bill, not the prostitution. Just to be clear, wherever the recording is. There was some, you know, he was all into this. It was something. There's something. It's another one that we use that same language. That
prostitution in juveniles?
No, I mean, it was in an omnibus. Okay. But it did come in. Yeah.
Oh, the omnibus.
It was in an there was some recidivist stuff, and it came up because I think it was Richard Gilbert who sort of made this, you know, but wait a second. Anyway, it's not just in standalone recidivists. There's another one that like takes it from a misdemeanor to a felony that says if it's more than one occasion, if it's on the same occasion, then it doesn't.
I mean, I would say like one thing that occasion and perhaps also event seems clear is that there's at least some distance between what's sufficient to satisfy like double jeopardy and between where this would draw the line. So like there's a DCCA opinion, the big one on the fresh impulse test, which said, you know, I think every within the course of like an hour long rape, that every 2 minutes or a few minutes if a guy chose to come back and engage in more sex, that was an additional
so that's another case.
Sexual assault. That, right, and so under the actor course of conduct, right? And interpreting that concept. Whereas I think like occasion would probably, or you know, there's something you could specify through the commentaries to say that is intended, whatever it means, it's intended to be broader than the actor course of conduct. Now that's a policy choice, but that would be one way.
And one.
Yeah. 2701, sorry, Richard, sure. Interrupt. Just because it is someplace sure. else. Engaging in prostitution or soliciting for prostitution, a person convicted of prostitution or soliciting who has two or more prior convictions for prostitution or soliciting for prostitution, not committed on the same occasion. So,
it crops up again. Like,
but it might also be a place to look at another place for legislative history where they were actually trying to figure out what that.
So,
I don't know that they thought it was terribly.
Yeah, thank you. We can look at it. I can say, you know, again, nothing in the legislative history here. Now, I haven't checked the 22-2701. I think that's, you know, we can look at it. All of this is kind of circling around, right, these same kind of, like, basic, like, where are you drawing the line? You know, if occasion sounds very temporal, right, like at the same time, maybe it's also place. Right, kind of as the sentencing guidelines go, the new same nucleus of facts seems to actually go further. Right, so things not just on the same occasion. Right, if again a fraudulent scheme occurs over the course of you know multiple days to reach fruition, well, I don't know, right? Like, it's either it's one offense that's occurring with elements occurring on satisfied at multiple days, or it's multiple offenses. You tell me, right? Like, is occasion sufficient? Is course of conduct sufficient? Is going with same act or course of? At this point, where do you end up? Or do you?
I feel like the word should be and. I don't know. I can't. I've now turned myself too around which way I want that to go. So I think.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, all of this.
Gosh, probably should have kicked me a long time ago.
I mean, I will say, like, in some sense, like, clarity on this isn't, like, you know, same day. There's a bright line rule, right? That's like, you know, it's temporal in nature, but it's like, you know.
All right. So, because I'm taking notes in multiple places, I'm realizing this is going to be disastrous. Do this today. Is it possible for you to cut that language or copy it and just send it to me in an email so that I can remember to study this a little more and think about it?
Sure. And when you say that language, which one?
The language.
In the new draft, what we were pitching, or the all of this? The current language, 22.18.04a, and then what was in the proposal here?
Give me both of those.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Tricky to do that right now. That can, after the meeting, can.
But you can do that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right. We'll do that. Yeah. Happy to send that to you. Yep. Okay. Well, we'll look at this some more. I honestly, it sounds like maybe you all need to like think a bit more about this too, in terms of what you'd prefer. So you know, maybe this is, you know, leaving it occasion is another way to go, which is keeps the same same language, it may be unclear, but it's,
yeah. Yeah, after you point that out, the other two, no, I'm not
going. Yeah,
so, I'd like to hear what you would say.
And again, I think because none of them are sufficiently clear, right? If anything, act or course of conduct is probably the clearest, just because there's been litigation on this in other areas. It's hard to even compare this, right? Like, it's language, just language gesturing at different things without much more. All right. If there's nothing else on this, and we've addressed the friendly amendments and dealing with partnering, which seems great, all right, to move on. If there's no other comments on that piece, let's see. OAG had also mentioned, so for the hate crime penalty, I think, you know, there was certainly no intent that the word injure, it sounds like the word was meant to preclude property offenses. So, and I think OAG's comment had suggested, you know, this phrasing seems to leave out then property offenses, that would be a narrowing of it, that was certainly not intended, and if the word injure has that connotation or at least possibility, what I'd suggest is changing that to just simply harm. So the word injure becomes harm, such that, again, it applies to an offense when the offender commits the offense with intent to harm or intimidate another person. Would that address your concern, Dave?
Well, you're saying you purposely left that property offenses.
No, there's we did not mean to any way
because
leave out property.
Because I quoted the statute, which included property offenses, right? The definition of designated act in 22. I'm sorry.
What property offense are you thinking about where intimidation doesn't cover it? I mean, I don't know that property offenses should be in it.
Yeah,
but it's already in the law, though, right? That's.
Well, so what we have is there are issues where I think, you know, you're harming a person without the store owner. Somebody has a better hypo, jump in. But a store owner, you're causing damage to that property, and it can be shown not because, you know, a hate symbol is left behind or anything of that sort, but from other evidence that appears, right? Other evidence comes up that shows that, yeah, that property damage, which otherwise appears and did not obviously communicate a hate message, right, or a message of, you know, showing prejudice or intimidate that way. To the store owner, it might very reasonably, or anybody might reasonably have been seen as just like a harm, right? You know, I've lost something. But if you can show that it was, in fact, because of prejudice through whatever other evidence, that would be covered. Is that
yeah, I get it, I get it, I get it. Yeah, I was okay. Just thinking cross-purposes. But you're right.
Okay, yeah, no, right. Yeah. It's broad. It is very broad. Dave, do you need a minute or you?
Yeah, I'm okay. Sorry. I just want to check what the current law says.
Sure. I can pull that up on the screen.
No, I never get the book.
Okay.
Yeah, it says designated act means a criminal act, including arson, assault, burglary, injury to property, so it includes all the property.
Yeah, and
so
we don't mean to change that at all.
Yeah, because it says that hate crime penalty applies to an offense.
Yeah.
Meaning, if you commit, so for example, if graffiti a swastika across the street from a synagogue or whatever, a Ku Klux Klan symbol, the crime being committed there is a property crime. Yeah. You are destroying. Yeah, it's that you've committed that crime with the intent to injure or intimidate another person because of prejudice.
We didn't mean to restrict this in any way. Right? Okay. This is any offense. And
the hate crime penalty, when it said intent to injure or intimidate another person, my question was, is it injuring the person or intimidating the person, and therefore leaving out property by implication? Or do we need to include something about property?
Right.
And the current law clearly has property in it.
Yeah.
So I'm worried that when it says injure or
intimidate
A person, that the Court of Appeals could say it's injuring a person.
We'd be
that then modifies
but what you're saying is you commit the offense,
right,
whatever it is,
that's
it
right.
Can be a property offense with the intent
that's
to
right.
do that.
Okay,
right.
Okay.
That's
so
right.
Okay, I got it. I can now I get
yeah.
the issues.
So, and we can clarify that sort of in the commentary that you know this includes property offenses. We can
that's
we can
right.
add a line. That would take
that.
Care of that.
Okay. That would take care of that.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. That it wasn't meant to limit current 2230.
Yes, no, and we didn't intend that.
Yeah, no, that solves my problem.
Good.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. And, you know, in layman's term, I mean, we all use hate crime. We simply pointed out that as a technical matter, I think the case law is bias related.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah. Any preference on that, or like?
We just need to say, hey, we're going to rename it because that's what people call it.
Yeah.
And one of our duties is to, give notes.
Make it more understandable.
If that helps you more to understand what hate crime, what a bias-related crime really is. But we just wanted to make that point that whenever we do that, if it's intentional, and I don't think we have an issue with it, we just simply point that out.
Good. Yeah. No. I.
So I don't know how you guys feel about it. I mean, all the case laws is bias related.
Sure.
But we just say, hey, this is what we're calling it, and we mean for it to track the Court of Appeals usage.
Yeah, we can definitely, like, thought we'd add something in the commentary just to kind of flag that fact, that change.
I just want to make sure. Are you suggesting that we just change hate crime wherever it appears to bias related, or are you saying that we just note that this is now?
Well, there's a choice.
Right.
You could go back and use the phrasing that the DC Court of Appeals uses, and that's bias related, wherever that makes sense, so that we are clear and consistent on that, and it's like not a change, it's meant to suggest any other change in the law. Or if you're going to use hate crime, then say, hey, we understand that they
was previously
use this,
noticed.
And this is simply meant to refer to all that stuff.
Yeah.
Because in the technical way, maybe the court has used that because bias in my mind, doesn't have to be what a lot of people associate with the word hate either. So
that's true.
It's a more careful and more precise use for all the things of this could be. So I don't know.
Well, they use bias because that's in the statute.
Yeah.
It says bias-related crimes in quotes means. And so the court of appeals would use it however it's defined. So I think you're preserving.
And bias makes sense to me because I can think of some examples of where people aren't actually acting in a way that a layperson thinks of hatred, but that's they are acting in a way that is biased, absent some sort of like this other thing that people think is hate.
You bet. And on that point, I skip around a little bit off of the OAG comments because. PDS had a comment in a related, skip to it, but you know, to strip from this list of kind of predicate bases, right? Some of these, which again, this list is it's in the current statute. This was what we proposed, just kind of copies the current statute, which is derived from DC Human Rights Act and targeting much more civil liability. So, you know, PDS wanted, I think particularly, correct me if I'm wrong, I'll look at my notes, was marital status, personal appearance, family responsibility, matriculation, were the ones that you had, that PDS had highlighted and suggested deleting from this, right? Now, that would be a change to current law. I'm not aware of any prosecutions that have ever, right, like, gone on the basis of, you know, bias based on marital status.
Why not, though? So let's be very clear on this. Yeah. I think we got to be careful here.
Yeah.
Because sometimes these things are related. So I can give you some examples. What if there are two females who are married? Then that's a sort of marital status that's connected to something else, too. Mm-hmm. Or two men, or a transgender female, and anyone else that can be marital status. Or what if you went to an historically black college or university? Or what if you go to a university that historically is connected with a particular religious faith?
But all those would be captured by the others. Those, I mean,
right?
Those would all be captured. So, for example,
it's not like I want to be gay.
So you're saying, go at the underlying thing, which in the examples that I've given, you're right. I could identify that, but I don't know. I would like to think that I'm not the kind of person who might be able to imagine all the bias. I mean, why do they write that?
What
were they thinking of if they weren't thinking of what I just said?
Because it tracks the Human Rights Act.
Yeah. So they just imported this over from the DC Human Rights Act.
Because you're an unmarried mother or something, right? That's not okay. I don't even know what matriculation means, but I guess it's
a matriculation is.
Where you went to school.
You
are a student.
Exactly.
Well, that's what you think it is, but I just gave an example where
you're a student.
But you're right, and my example is connected to the other thing, and not just the fact that I'm sorry, you only went to a third church school.
Yeah, I
don't fight tech because you weigh 350 pounds.
I think I did.
Yeah.
Right.
I, in personal appearance, some of this has, so I would say this. I, one thing I wanted to clarify, because this had come up, one of the examples that the PDS had given, I think, is not what we intended here, which was, sorry, I'll skip to the. To that, but it, you know, the example was, I'll let me pull it on the screen so everybody can kind of see it. Same language.
No, it is the same language. We must have looked it up.
We know that
it is the same language. Yeah, it's the same. Yeah. And so, you know, again, why did the council not change that when they brought it over?
Yeah, I'd be loath to change that,
but
if it's tracking that.
No, they're different.
Well,
but if it's a, but I don't know, Laura. I just don't know. Like, is it an act of like terrorism? I don't know. Somebody could lose their mind and go to an apartment building that somehow seemed like it was only written out to single people, and like start. I don't know
write nasty things on the wall and making them feel, and then you assault one of them. I don't know.
You get an assault.
Yeah. So, one thing we're just highlighting is that, right?
Well, maybe somebody kills all the Harvard people in one. Oh, PDS, you get blown up because you got so many Harvard graduates over there. I don't know.
No, but I think it's a public. There's like a public defender protection one.
Right.
Covered even when you're Harvard.
I love that.
I think so. And we'd be the first ones to argue, don't apply hate crime, but whatever.
So the statutory maxima are sufficiently capacious to encompass a whole bunch of things, right? Like when you put statutory maxima on offenses, you're not writing them for the bare threshold of committing those elements. There's padding in there, and like the padding takes care of a whole host of things. It takes into account criminal history score under the guidelines. You know, they're aggravating departing factors. So the question is not whether all the things that you describe are merit criminalization or merit punishment. It's, are they of such a categorically different nature that the statutory maxima for that offense can't already address it, and you actually have to bump the statutory maxima to make room for it, where it's like your sort of classic discrimination cases. I mean, that's one thing, but when you're, as you move to things like matriculation, stuff like that, I think it's at least an open question whether that's so categorical, you know, whether terrorism, where you kill 100 people.
Based on wearing white after Labor Day, which is personal appearance, I know. And
okay, you said that to me because you know I am Southern, but I would never commit a crime against someone because they did such gauche thing. She looked at me when she said that.
In her white shirt.
Shoes and stuff like that. What that look for? What it nails it.
All right, like, but I would get the hate.
I get the hate crime. I'm all right.
The draft text.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so it applies to the defense when.
This is like the old days. There's gonna be a punch bowl.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. It's gonna eggnog.
And I'm sorry, did you have 22807 or
No, 22. It's the 22. What do you call it? It's 3701. She would be removing those from the current law.
Right, that would be a change in current law.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. We're changing.
What PDS is pitching is changing current law.
All right, so.
See, of all the ones that I don't think have an underlying one, it's personal appearance. Because I think people do act on personal appearance, and it's not an underlying one, like you could say.
Any of those
example,
other things.
Yeah. Really is race.
It's just the personal appearance.
He's 500 pounds, and I just, I'm just going to, do what I'm going to do.
Well, so one thing I would point out, and this is maybe something to clarify across the board, which again, so the PDS comment had this example, for instance, by including marital status and family responsibility, a defendant who kills an ex-husband because of a bitter divorce or because the ex-husband fails to take on family responsibility may be subject to a hate crime enhancement. A teenager commits a robbery motivated by anger at a complainant's flashy personal appearance could similarly be subject to a hate crime enhancement. And I guess I wanted to point out one kind of across-the-board thing, whether it's based on race or religion or personal appearance, that I think, throughout our intent by requiring prejudice, in the current language also about bias, is to emphasize that this is not a particularized to a particular person, right? In other words, every cross-racial assault is not therefore a hate crime, right? Even if it was in part because I knew also that you go to Harvard, right? Or you went to Harvard, right? Like that kind of thing. The question raising bias or prejudice, I believe, and I don't know how much we look again at how much legislative history bears this out, is a kind of a categorical kind of a view towards a group of people, right? And it's going to come up in a particular instance, right? But if, for instance, like here in the example of a defendant who kills an ex-husband because of a bitter divorce, right? It is certainly true.
I dislike all ex-husbands.
Well, now, right, if that's what's going on, right? And same thing about personal appearance. I think if it was a categorical thing about people who look a certain way, right, and, you know, people develop weird MOs for when they commit assaults. Like, they target a particular type of people. Now, maybe it's because of vulnerability, maybe it's their appearance.
Exactly.
I don't know. It might be an issue, but what we're talking about is not simply, again, like, and I think we put this in the commentary, you know, a person who targets elderly persons because they're easier prey for whatever the scheme is not necessarily committing a hate crime, right? The question is, do they have this underlying bias which is categorically motivating them, right? A bias or prejudice. And so there's a distinction there that I think it's hard when you've got a single incident.
But that isn't what it says, right? It doesn't say because the person is perceived to be a member of a group that, right? It's not, it is about that person. It's written that it's about that person. It is that person's race, right? I don't think
because of the thing.
Right.
Now,
I don't think they have to prove that the defendant hates all black people.
Well, it's prejudice against that person's perceived race.
Perceived. That's right.
Yeah.
Actual or perceived.
Yeah, I think the sort of like the boiled down is: did the person intend to send a message that was based upon one of these categories when they committed the crime? Like, did it send a message that, like, you know, against race, against...
That isn't what it says.
Yeah,
it's not what it says. It may be what you want it to mean.
I think it does, because, in fact, there have been some cases where perhaps even the judge... Maybe the judge was wrong, I don't know. But perhaps the judge did not articulate it well. Because sometimes you can have a person or persons who fall into these categories.
Yeah.
They are, you know, overweight,
right,
or they are married, or they are single, or they are exes, or they are gay or black. And the reason that this horrible thing happened to them or to their property is not because the defendant had an intent to injure or intimidate them because of it. And so when you're looking at that, because the victim is in the category, you're looking for evidence of that intent, right? Did they, you know, put a swastika on the house? Did they yell, you, whatever the word for the group that you may fit in, that is, you know. And sometimes there have been cases where there was evidence of that. The person was yelling that word. And yet, for that judge, perhaps, or the jury, there were other things that came into play that suggested to them that notwithstanding that, it was not a bias-related crime. So I say all of that to say that I think it's complicated. And it is the reason that you can have an outcome in a case like that where the person seems to be yelling something at somebody where you'd be like, oh, I think that was...
Yeah.
And there's other factors where another person says, but if you look at all of this, I don't think so. What you're getting at is people are interpreting... You wouldn't get that if you just said, oh, that person does fall in that category, and there were words or symbols that relate to that category, that would be the end of the analysis. But what must be happening is that they're looking at, notwithstanding that,
did that supply or does that prove up the intent to do what they did because of that thing?
Yeah. And that motivational link, right? So we talked about this some in the commentary. It's a concern with the current district statute, just the exact phrasing. There's one other state which actually somewhat similarly doesn't, you know, the Supreme Court's looked at this, it's upheld hate crime statutes with this type of connection between the intent and the act itself. So it isn't sufficient to simply say, right, that regardless of the person's intent, it appeared objectively to a third person quite reasonably to the public to have been a hate crime. That's not enough. That's then tacking on essentially a separate penalty for something unrelated to anything that person did. You know, kind of fails a basic due process. On constitutional grounds, that link between this particular kind of motive meeting this circumstance. Now, prejudice, the word, I think it is doing some work here, and it's doing work to generalize beyond a particular person, right? So you could just have this with intent to injure or intimidate another person because of that person's race, color, etc., suggesting that, in an instant, somebody, listens to some fear-mongering, hate something on radio, and turns around, and there's a person exemplifying that, and,
What do we think personal appearance means that isn't captured? I can imagine what it maybe used to mean, but how would it be understood now when we still have gender identity or...
Well, that's what David was saying. Is the weight, right, which is not otherwise represented.
Weight, it could be
there.
Long hair for men. Dreads.
That's borderline.
Might border on some other stuff.
But like a subcultures. Like if a person wears a lot of black clothes.
So all of these things, right?
Right. And that aren't also represented.
I would say this.
I guess if it's in the human, this is crazy.
Yeah.
This is crazy. Yeah. I mean, I don't like hate crime penalty.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, stop it already, right? I mean, fine, if we're going to protect some groups by saying if you commit a crime, all this, like certain victims, it's all worse, I have problems with. But okay, we can select out certain ones. But you can always find a group that someone's in. I do not like people that went to Princeton. I don't. But, like, for really? I mean, yeah. One, okay, would never commit a crime. But, like, so what?
Right.
Really? Do the Princeton people need protection?
Right.
Apparently they do for me.
Certainly, this is the issue,
just
right?
Just identified yourself.
Is whether, on a civil level, this was definitely appropriate. And I think the question, the relevant policy question is, again, and as Michael framed it, do we want this special penalty enhancement for to highlight particular groups, and then we're going to put in those groups both race, color, religion, national, some of these traditional, highly protected categories with these other categories, which are we going to equate those and also raise those up as deserving special extra punishment, or is that within the ambit of the rest of our criminal code's normal give and take?
Should also add that, like, this is the broadest list.
This is the broadest list that we found anywhere.
Yeah.
So the current DC law, which this list of things is the broadest, most expansive that we found anywhere.
Did you find any other list that was like this one? Where did DC get it?
It's just this Human Rights Act. We only did state level stuff.
There, so there would be right. That's true.
There might be some, like, New York, some counties and local jurisdictions have their own, whatever. We never in any of our comparisons have been looking at criminal law authority of sub-state jurisdictions.
Gotcha. Okay.
But so maybe I don't. Maybe.
So I understand Laura's PDS's concern that really, where do you stop the list? On the other hand, it's not like they came up with this. It's pulled from, you know, the DC Human Rights law, and I just would be very, very reluctant to delete from that list. And I know that on the one hand, that this won't be compelling to you, but as far as enhancements go, it is on the one hand difficult when the government files enhancement papers to actually have judges apply them. I know that that argument didn't go far with you, and believe me, I understand that in the court I'm going to be using that. And some people would argue that the reason for that is because judges do what judges do. You know, they make the decisions about sentencing, and in cases where an enhancement, because there's a firearm or any other kind of reason, is being asked for, when you start making the comparisons, a lot of times those sentences, they take care of themselves because of all the other factors that the judge is already considering. So, you know, I look at this and I think, though I know that brings you no comfort because you're arguing for the absolutes.
And for being, for criminal justice policy that makes sense, that is proportional. I mean, I hope there are other offenses that were perhaps passed in a political climate and a political moment that are, like, ridiculous, that we could now sort of say that that's not proportional. We could rewrite that. We could certainly have a different penalty. I don't know, carjack. You know, just because it was...
Drawing on in support of what both of you are saying, the first 50-state review of the enforcement of hate crimes suggests that they are not brought against the prototypical hate crime cases, for the most part, because of just what Renata said. They're already at the statutory maxima. It's difficult. You got to prove the firearms. More stuff that you have to file and you have to prove. However, and somewhat frustratingly, they are often brought at the marginal cases, or at least charged in the marginal cases, for reasons that everyone can anticipate, right? When you charge and you want to get to a plea deal, adding the counts increases the pressure to plead, even if they aren't actually brought and out in the final sentencing. And so there is this kind of strange pattern that was unanticipated by the proponents of hate crime legislation, in which they, hate crime legislation itself is not brought in the heartland of what the proponents anticipated, but rather at the margins. And it is frustrating because it does generate, even in practice around the country, kind of strange and unanticipated results.
Well, let me, let me kind of call the question, as it were, and just say, like, any other comments or, you know, voices of agreement or disagreement with the PDS? I hear USAO saying, we just assume, kind of, keep the current language, not eliminate these others. We'd be very reluctant to do that, at least.
Yeah, it's just been consistent with our original, I think a long time ago we said, our office, that we are not here to change the law in substantive ways, and that we were willing to live with that wherever it fell. When it seemed that it might be something that was favorable to our office, and when it seemed that it was unfavorable to what might be viewed as our office's usual position, but that is how we were going to play it.
Dave, Don, any other, you want to chime in on this
one way or the other, keep these in, take them out, or your ambivalence?
I was trying to look up matriculation to see what the full thing, I mean, yeah. When in doubt, and you're arguing for what it reveals, you get a dictionary, and I wasn't able to find matriculation actually has a much broader meaning than merely acceptance or moving to another level in school. So matriculation is a tricky one for me.
Okay.
Personal appearance is one that I sort of feel strongly should be in there.
Should be.
Yeah, okay. Because of situations like bad people, people dread mobs, whatever, which don't necessarily fall over, which people do for one reason or another have some antipathy to.
And Dave has just demonstrated why he can't stand people who went to college. at all, because they're like looking at stuff. I'm debating.
Checking that dictionary.
I do think I
mean, I don't want to say anything too political.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's 27% of the American public just voted against, you know, said things about people who graduated from college. You know, so.
There we go. Dawn. Oh, sorry.
No, very minor point. I did the EEO training through the OHR, the Office of Human Rights, and the matriculation, to my recollection, in that context, is actually very narrow. It was like, are you currently in school? Period.
That's
now, there's nothing that would indicate that in the plain language of this, you know, the current or the proposed, but that, at least in the human rights context for the EEO, that was my recollection. The very narrow. Are you in school?
See, that says so much because we started at where did you go to school?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because you think about it, it kind of makes sense too. It's about housing and employment, and you know, if you're in school and you have extra responsibilities, someone else does. It's kind of where it's going, and they really drilled that point home. It's like only you, and if you're in school.
And that's where marital status probably comes from.
All
and not a more complicated view that I was saying that is rooted in other things, like a marriage where one partner is transgender or a marriage of a gay marriage. And it wasn't that when they were thinking about it. And that's why, you know, things evolve. And yet Laura's saying, evolve or not, you know, come on.
Katya Don was a dicey. All right. Well, let me see this. So we're getting towards the end too, and there are some other things. I Michael hasn't talked to you about attempt. I would say this. You know, we just kind of mentioned a few other things because I don't know that there was anything else that we kind of formatively need to talk to you. David mentioned, you know, adding an in fact, referring to another.
I just thought that was a little thing up to decent.
Yeah, and this is that was a good catch. And I will say this, is you see property offenses, this is kind of a drafting choice. At times in the gradations you'll see we refer to somebody who committed X offense, you know, the underlying this, plus did this. And the drafting choice we face is whether you say, in fact, committed this plus did this. The danger there is then somebody might think, oh, well, then somehow that strips the mental state requirement from the underlying offense. We don't mean that. If you don't say anything, they might read something. So we'll be consistent about this. We don't mean to do that. And so we'll add the in fact in there. I think that was a good catch, Dave. And but it's a larger drafting matter to be aware of going forward. One other thing he mentioned was there was a reference to the defendant versus the offender. I'm awe, you know, without going into a long discussion on the merits of one or the other, I think would like to be consistent. Generally, we've gone with defendant, I think, in most of the writing, but we haven't been totally consistent. So if that's all right, and this is, again, largely for the commentary, right? There are a few places in the statute where it gets circuitous to reference the person who did, you know, it just gets too confusing. So we need to, like, clarify it. Is defendant versus offender okay way? I'm kind of looking at Laura if there's a concern over that. Okay. Then we'll go with defendant as just kind of a uniform.
Whatever you want to be consistent with, it done.
Okay.
You know, other matters to talk about that I didn't raise. Talked to, you know, Renata had a point about hate crimes, the naming.
So what was the view on that? Did he decide anything?
No, I mean, my sense is that is there a preference? Do people like renaming bias related crime hate crime, or keeping it bias related crime? I think that's good. I totally agree. At the very least, we can flag that, you know, we're doing this right, like in the kind of note this as a change, not a substantive one. It is meant to be, you know, a consistent one. Frankly, it's just a matter of, as we looked at other places, is this communicate kind of like, on the one hand, you want this gut level, you want people to understand what we were talking about when you're talking about hate crime. On the other hand, you don't want them to leap to assumptions about whatever they have in their head about hate. So what we kept was, you know, the language in the statute.
Or the substance.
Yeah, the substance, but the label for the whole thing, hate crime. Thoughts?
To me, it's completely related to the previous discussion we were having, right?
Okay.
I mean, if you keep in that other bullshit stuff, then you ought to call it bias-related, because that at least implies, you know, there's just a whole lot of stuff in here you may have some feelings about. I mean, seriously,
because
okay,
you think that communicates, like, the breadth more. Like, if
right,
it's bias-related,
exactly,
that sounds more breadth.
Exactly.
If it's hate crime, you think
you
the traditional categories
like,
of, you know, race,
it.
Gender. Okay. Okay. Mm. There we go. Any other thoughts on that point? Okay. Well, then we will kind of take under advisement the more basic question and difference of views on whether some of these things should be incorporated. So let me check in with Michael. Okay. So Michael's going to kind of talk a bit about some of the attempt stuff. We can hold it over if it spills over. I'd like to take a break, though, in like 5-7 minutes so that we have a little potty break.
Should we take it now right before we switch horses?
But, well, we so about 4, these ethics folks are going to show about 4.
Oh,
potty break for 15 minutes.
Oh,
well,
yeah, so let's finish.
Well, so
we
if Michael has maybe 5 minutes to get at least going and address a few things, and then we'll see how much. It may be that there's not much more to address on the comments on attempt. If we can wrap that up today, great. If we need to carry it over, then we have to carry it over.
I have to be back in my office by 4. I'm sorry.
Okay.
For a meeting related to our.
Okay.
Whatever.
You give us 7 minutes and then you got to go. Does that sound ish, right?
5 to 7.
So I'll be quick. So, yeah, so first, there were some helpful editorial comments. I'd say in the future, you can just email us those. Those don't necessarily have to go in writing. And submit.
Really,
it
I can't preserve my technical.
You can. You're welcome.
You can call up Bryson and get.
Because yeah. Otherwise, you won't even think we read it.
Well, if you want to impress us, finally get an editorial comment then, like on page like 46 rather than on page 3. But anyways, just saying. Regardless,
you're talking about footnote 37.
I will. But we didn't.
I actually thought you were talking about
so
me.
Yeah, no. So anyways, they're welcome. They're welcome. They're good.
We need that. We appreciate the feedback. We appreciate
it's the only thing I added.
So
I'm not going to do it. I'll like put them in an editorial bullet so it's clear.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We appreciate all the feedback for you. All
right.
I am not going to take twice as long. I just will put them in one place.
Good. Whatever works best for you.
Okay.
All right. So.
I know. I'm sorry.
5 minutes. Four minutes.
Okay. So PDS had a bunch of helpful drafting recommendations. One was to add the term conduct. So the reference is to not a person being dangerously close, but the person's conduct. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. With that, we'll incorporate that next draft. PDS had another helpful drafting recommendation, which is to change the focus from committing that offense, which is it currently has, to accomplishment of the offense. I think that completion, which actually PDS uses in its own comments as well and also gets used, is a little bit just more plain English than accomplishment, and you see that more often in other statutes. So I think we're probably leaning towards completion instead of accomplishment, but the basic point remains, and it's a useful one, that the focus ought not to be on committing, but rather finishing, whether it's accomplishing or completing. A more substantive point that PDS had, which we're still thinking through, but definitely open to, seems, you know, is whether this reasonable adaptation requirement ought to be required to both prongs of the conduct requirement for an attempt. I should say that in where you're not relying on the defendant's perspective of the situation, where it is just a sort of classic looking from the outside, was this dangerously close to finishing, by definition, it's going to be reasonably adapted, because in those situations, you're taking an objective view of the situation, and so reasonably adapted is a much lower standard than sort of like objective dangerous closeness. That being said, you know, there certainly is a basis for it in district law, in the sense that these things are just generally articulated together, and I don't think it would necessarily hurt to put it in. So, you know, the thought was perhaps it would be simpler to limit it to where you really need it to rely on it, but at the same time, there's low cost to incorporating it as well. So that's something, you know, we'll think a little bit more on, but generally open to. PDS had two questions or two recommendations concerning specific hypotheticals, in particular footnotes. Both of them hinged upon, at least in part, on some complexities about grading attempts and how it interacts with assault. The recommendation is, let's wait until we've made recommendations on penalties and thought through grading of attempts and assaults, and then just look back at those hypotheticals to see if they still make sense or not. And then lastly, USAO had a comment about whether or not we ought to discuss whether there's a difference between dangerous proximity and substantial step in light of Hailstock. Pages 14 through 16 of memo gave a two-page explanation of why in staff.
Yeah, but it doesn't make sense to me, because on the one hand, I bought your argument. Okay, you're using dangerous proximity.
Right.
And then you get to pages 14 through 16, and you acknowledge Hailstock.
Right.
And then sort of brush it aside. The first time you make the acknowledgement is like to say, well, Hailstock and what's the other case?
Mobley.
I'm sorry?
Mobley. Yeah.
Simply define a hybrid, which basically says to have the incomplete attempt, you need you either need a substantial step or... you either have to have the but-for situation, but-for interference,
yeah,
it would have been completed, or you have to have a substantial step. And so I bought that argument, that all they're doing, and these are cases that are like 2014, right?
Right.
So there are more recent cases than all these other ones, and I bought your argument at that point that, okay, this, it's really not much difference, and if there's a difference, then all Hailstock is doing in Mobley are defining it in a rather complete way, and they're using dangerous proximity in the definition. But then you come back later and you say, hey, but it's totally unclear. Whatever significance that Hailstock and Mobley have is completely unclear, which to me is inconsistent with the first argument I thought you were making, is that they don't do anything to change really how the D.C. Court of Appeals was thinking.
Right. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that was where Michael meant to go. So I think the problem might have been if there was some language in the commentary that communicated the second point about going back. Because I think that would be I think Michael would stand by the first part, which is like, yeah, those opinions shouldn't...
They didn't
change all the attempt law.
In fact, in my mind, they sort of clarified. If you thought there was some difference, look, this is what they're saying. They're actually picking up their language, using it together, and saying, this is what you're looking for. You're either going to have but-for interference is completed type of case, or you're going to have
what people understand as a substantial
step.
Let me
just quickly summarize. So my visit, or what, in terms of, as I was writing this, what I had in mind is, first, as a historical and contemporary matter, substantial step and dangerous proximity are two fundamentally different tests. They draw the line in two different places. When the MPC drafters were writing, came up with a substantial step, their clear intent was to expand beyond the scope of dangerous proximity based upon certain policy commitments that they had. Some states have gone with it, some haven't. All of DC's law, other than these two just sort of offhand references to substantial step, reflect the common law dangerous proximity approach. When it was adopted in 1978, the reference was to Holmes, who's the progenitor of the whole thing, and that has continued forward, including to like Corbin, which is 2015, which uses the sort of classical definition of dangerous proximity. Mobley and...
Well, does Corbin? Because Corbin to me was even more confusing, because while I thought I understood that Hellstock and Mobley came up with this definition that to me was disjunctive. We either have to have this or that.
Hi, come on in. Yeah.
Took the hybrid and made it conjunctive. You got to have both those things together.
Which is how the Red Book jury.
I think I'm going to cut us off. This is important. We'll pick up again with this at the next meeting. Okay, a couple weeks.
First.
Yes. We'll do first, that first on the agenda. We should take a short break so that our folks from Bega can set up. So if everybody wants to take a 10-minute break, that'd be great. Thank you for, thank you. And
thank you. This was like all
good
time.
Good, okay.